April 26, 2007. Committee members, you'll see that we have quite a long agenda this morning, although there are a few items that will be coming to be set over. Just to give you an indication of where we're headed, we're going to start out with the public hearing on 2553. We'll not be opening a public hearing on 2554. Then going to the public hearing at the top of the second page, or near the top, House Bill 2325. The public hearings on 2331 and 2327 will be set over till tomorrow because we're waiting for further work on amendments. And then we'll be taking the work sessions I'll work out the order of those as we get into them after we've gone into hearing. So I will now open a public hearing on House Bill 2553. Council Taylor.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2553 comes to you from Representative Crummell. Prohibits the administrator of the Division of Child Support from seeking reimbursement from a parent or other person with a legal duty to support a child removed from a house or home on account of allegations of abuse and neglect unless, A, the parent has been convicted of a crime that involved the neglect or abuse of the child, or B, the child has been found to be in the jurisdiction of the court for abuse and neglect. Chair, members of the committee, we just received a little while ago -1 amendments that I understand that Representative Crummell has worked out with Ramona Crowley from Children, DHS.
Very good. Representative Crummell, why don't you come forward and tell us about this bill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, for the record, State Representative Jerry Crummell, House District 26, Wilsonville, Sherwood, and over to Gaston. The genesis of this bill was a family that is in my district had their children picked up by Child Protective Services after going through a process for about 8 months. It was found that the allegations were unfounded, and then they started getting a bill from the state for child support for while the children were in custody. The interesting thing about this is that, not to make a sad sob story, but basically it was a matter of once we destroyed the family unit, then we decided to see if we could destroy them financially. This had a very negative financial effect on the family. They are recovering. We were able to step in and try to help them work through some of the process, but we decided that one of the things we needed to do is make the statute more clear from a standpoint of when a child goes into foster care, when child support would be sought from the family and when it would not. I have worked with Ramona Foley and Mickey Cerise over at Child Protective Services. They had some concerns about the bill. So before you is the -1 amendments. And what I would, Mr. Chair, if you do take the bill into work session, which I hope you will, is that I would like for the committee to adopt the -1 amendments into the bill and then, of course, move the bill to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I think that this is good policy, and I'd be happy to answer any questions. I don't want to take any more of your time than we need to.
Thank you, Representative Crummell. I'm looking for the -1 amendments here.
They were just passed out just as about 5 minutes ago.
Those are hot off the press. I just picked them up this morning.
Yeah, dude, I have one.
The major changes, Mr. Chair, are in the definition of public assistance starting on line 15 on page 2 of the -1 amendments, and then also clarifying when the bill takes effect clarifying when the cases that this would apply to. So this would not apply to any cases that are current. It would apply only to cases in which a child is taken into protective custody on or after the effective date of the act, and the act would take effect 91 days after the close of session.
Council Taylor.
Members, can we represent Crummell? Reading the amendments quickly, I see that in the amendments as opposed to the bill, public assistance does not include money payments made by the state to the benefit of a dependent child. As a result, the child is removed from the parent's home against the wishes of the parent if the Department of Human Services determines after completion of a child protective service assessment that the report of abuse is unfounded. That's if I remember the bill, it was we were talking about criminal convictions. So now it's a determination by the Department of Human Services that the allegations are unfounded. Is that correct?
That is correct, Mr. Chair and members of the committee and council. That is correct. They are, and we worked out this language with the department. Unfounded is a term that's utilized in the department's rule in terms of the determination of a Child Protective Services case. And so we are using that language as opposed to looking at a criminal conviction, because when a child is taken into protective custody, it may not involve a criminal act. There may or may not be criminal activity and that sort of thing. So that's why the department preferred to have this type of language in the bill as opposed to the language that we had originally in the bill.
One further question, Mr. Chairman.
Mr.
Kremel, I understand that this will not get us crosswise with the federal government.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee and council, that is correct. This will not get us crosswise with the feds. Federal statute allows for states to have exceptions to when there are when child support will be asked for and demanded, and this is one of those exceptions that is acceptable. I've also worked with Tom Hedberg over at the Department of Justice to make sure that we would be okay with that. I do know that Ramona Foley is in the audience and is willing to answer any questions. I don't think she's going to come up and rain on the parade. And I know that Mr. Hedberg is also in the audience and would probably be willing to answer questions.
I think it might be helpful to have Ms. Foley come forward just so we get this recorded here in our public hearing about the department's position.
We will even sit side by side.
Okay. Ms. Foley, so we're understanding that then with the -1 amendments that 2553 is it's supported or at least not opposed by the department?
Chairman McPherson and members of the committee, that is true. And for the record, I'm Ramona Foley from the Department of Human Services.
Very good.
We started the conversation because the concerns were around trying to comply with federal statute, which has an intent of looking at child support on any child coming into foster care. But the intent of this change, and we have spent quite a bit of time discussing this, is that if the Department of Human Services were to make an error or a mistake and have a child come into care, and then that case ultimately is unfounded, we would not want to penalize the parent not only by the trauma of the child being removed, but then by collecting child support on that particular case. We don't believe this will apply to many cases, but we have worked with the Department of Child Support Enforcement to make sure that this would still be in compliance with federal law, and we think it's a good public statement about the fact that we don't want to penalize parents in that way if the child should not have come into care.
And Ms. Foley, do you make a determination about whether or not allegations are founded or unfounded? Is this something that would show up or regularly in the processing of allegations?
Chair McPherson, in all cases in which we're doing a child protective service assessment, we have to make a disposition, and that would include unfounded as well as founded.
Very good. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Okay, thank you very much. I will close the public hearing then on House Bill 2553 and open a work session on House Bill 2553. Representative Krieger.
I'd like to move the -1 amendments into 2553.
Representative Krieger moves the -1 amendments into House Bill 2553. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the -1 amendments are in the bill.
Chair, move House Bill 2553 as amended to the House with a due pass.
Representative Krieger moves House Bill 2553 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Barker.
Aye. Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wendt.
Aye.
Chairman
Person. Aye. House Bill 2553 moves to the floor with a do pass recommendation as amended. And Representative Krieger or Representative Crummell, would you like to carry that bill?
I'd be happy to.
Yeah, very good. And unless you want to arm wrestle him for it, Representative Krieger.
I'm going to ask him some questions.
I'm looking forward to that. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2553 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2325.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2325, the -2 amendments are the bill. And basically what the bill does is requires the Department of Corrections beginning in 2012 and every 6 years thereafter to conduct a study of the actual cost of the county providing management support services and supervision for offenders on parole, probation, and post-prison supervision or sentence of 12 months or less. It requires the Department to use its results to adjust the rates the state will reimburse counties. Chairman of the committee, in Oregon, if someone is convicted of a felony, and they serve less than 12 months or less, and they go to the local county jail rather than the Department of Corrections. And there's an agreement between, and has been since 1995, between the Department of Corrections and the counties to reimburse them for their expenses involved here. And this is the issue here is about when it should be readjusted and how. I believe Scott Taylor and Paul Snyder are in the audience, and would be more than willing to testify on the bill.
Yeah, well, we have both those gentlemen come up, Mr. Snyder and Mr. Taylor.
Betty, I'm Paul Snyder, representing Association of Oregon Counties. I wonder, Mr. Chair, with the Chair's indulgence, if Troy Clausen from Community Corrections Directors could join us. And I noticed that John Powell from the Sheriff's Association is in the room, and he may want to join us as well. Mr. Chair and members, the amendments to House Bill 2325 relate to a partnership between the counties and the state. The Community Corrections Act provides in its introductory provisions that this is a partnership under which the counties will provide a service for which the state will pay. And in 1993, the Department of Corrections did a thorough analysis of the cost of the actual cost of supervision under parole and probation. In 1998, the Sheriff's Association did a thorough analysis of the cost of county jails. Each time that happened, that information was put together and incorporated into the costs and the payments that the state would make to the counties and to others. That has not been done again until the year 2006, at which time the Department of Corrections, working with us and the Community Corrections Directors Association and the Sheriff's Association, did another actual cost analysis. That analysis was used to build the department's budget, proposed budget, for 2007 and 2009. But over that period of time, between 1999, when the base was reset, and now, there was growing concern and perception that the reimbursement to the counties was not keeping pace with the cost to the counties. And so we reached an agreement together last year with all these affected parties that there should be an actual cost analysis done once every 6 years to assure that the cost and the reimbursement rate don't get out of whack again. My understanding is that all these parties together agree that the amendments to House Bill 2325 should happen, should be adopted. It provides, therefore, then authorization to the department, assurance to the counties that this actual cost review will be done every 6 years. And that's the purpose of the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Snyder. Mr. Taylor.
For the record, I'm Scott Taylor, Chief of Community Corrections for the Department of Corrections, and Mr. Snyder has basically summarized the agreement we came to over several years.
Are there any questions for either of these witnesses? And Mr. Snyder, you mentioned that there were others you thought that may, although they're not signed up, that might want to comment on this. Would that be useful?
We have Mr. Chair Troy Clausen from the Community Corrections Directors Association and John Powell from the Sheriff's Association.
Okay. Very good. Gentlemen.
Chairman. I'm John Powell, representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association, and Paul has covered the history and the bill well. I wouldn't have anything to add for supporting.
Morning, Mr. Chair. Troy Clausen, representing the Oregon Association of Community Corrections Directors. And again, Mr. Steiner has done an excellent job of outlining this this process, and we just offer our support to it as well and like to see the amendment adopted.
Very good. Any further questions? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have a question about how the 6 years was arrived at, if that was a sort of compromise. It seems like a long time, and costs and expenses can change so much in 6 years.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, that was arrived at recognizing that the Department of Corrections and other state agencies include in their base budget a roll-up provision. And they treat counties as a contractor, and the contract rate, inflation rate, I think this year is 3.1% or 3.2% for the biennium. The risk that we see is that 3.1 or 3.2% inflation rate may not keep pace with the actual cost increases, but it won't get so far out of whack over a period of 6 years that we'll wind up losing a whole lot of money.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2325 and open a work session on House Bill 2325.
Mr. Chair, move the dash twos into House Bill 2325.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2325. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Then the dash two amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2325 as amended before it should be passed.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2325 as amended to the floor with the
The consent calendar.
And he includes the recommendation for the consent calendar in his motion. is there any discussion of that motion? Then the clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. House Bill 2325, as amended, moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation for placement on the consent calendar. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2325 and open a work session on House Joint Resolution 49.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Joint Resolution 49 amends Section 42, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, grants a victim the right to assert a claim to appellate court. Either by motion in a pending case of a writ of mandamus, if no case is pending, allows the suspension of lower court proceedings pending appeal, requires court to give expedited consideration of victims' claims made pursuant to Section 42. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the dash three amendments in front of you, and I know Pete Shepard's in the audience here, and he's has spent quite a bit of time on this. They have worked out amendments. I never thought I'd see it, but I understand that they... there are consent amendments worked out between the District Attorneys and Defense Bar, the Department of Justice, and the ACLU.
Yeah, Mr. Shepard, don't you come and walk us through the amendments?
That's what I'm looking at. It must be.
And would it be helpful if I were to open work session on Joint Resolution 50 as well, since they really interlace? You do that. I will open a work session on House Joint Resolution 50, so we're jointly in...
Mr. Chair, if I could, this amends Section 43, Article 1 of the Oregon Constitution, and you'd be looking at the bill plus the dash four amendments in this case.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Pete Shepard. I'm the Deputy Attorney General. Your able staff is handing out to you right now hand-engrossed versions of HGR 49 and HGR 50. These versions were... are engrossed with the dash 3 amendments to HGR 49 and the dash 4 amendments to HGR 50. And if they suffer from the vice of a bit of messiness, I think they have the virtue of being accurate reflections of those amendments, so you might want to look at those as you work through the amendments. After this committee's hearing on these two measures, these two resolutions, Attorney General Hardy Myers convened a work group to discuss possible amendments and to report back to this committee. Materials that you have just received in the form of the hand-engrossed versions of the two resolutions are the result of that work group. I have explicit authority to tell you that the 49-3 and 50-4 amendments are consensus amendments agreed to by Crime Victims United of Oregon, the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, Doug Ballouf, the professor of law and director of the National Crime Victims Law Institute at the Lewis and Clark Law School, and Attorney General Hardy Myers. I have not been able to confirm that I have explicit authority to make any representation about the ACLU's position, though I would predict that they support the amendments. Further, I'm authorized explicitly to tell the committee that each of the groups that I listed, exclusive of the ACLU, simply because I don't have authority explicitly from Ms. Meyer to make this representation, but each of the other groups support passage of the amended resolutions with the -3 and -4 amendments, respectively. I think what I probably could best help the committee do is just briefly describe the two basic principles that undergirded the work of the working group, and then be available for your questions. And the first basic principle is that amendments to Section 42 and 43 of the Bill of Rights must be made if victims of crime are to be empowered individually to enforce their rights. In other words, a constitutional amendment to each of those sections is required if we are to accomplish the policy goal of empowering victims individually to enforce their rights. No mere statutory remedy can accomplish that end. And the second principle that undergirded the work of the working group is that the Constitution, and particularly the Bill of Rights, is properly a place in which to fix basic rights, but it wouldn't be prudent unnecessarily to add procedural detail to the Bill of Rights. And so the amendments that we have presented to you seek to define and guarantee the basic rights without embedding unnecessarily in the Constitution procedural details. And let me draw your attention to just one aspect of the amendments by way of illustration of that principle. And this appears in both the amendments to H.R. 50 and 49. With respect to H.R. 50, the provision I'll discuss is on page 2, lines 14 and 15. And with respect to H.R. 49, it's on page 2, lines 11 and 12. And in these provisions of each of the two measures, we have provided that the amendments will open the courthouse doors to victims under procedures to be established by law. But it will, those same amendments guarantee to victims access to that courthouse, keeps those courthouse doors open, even in the event the assembly fails to act. And so again, the basic principle, not to embed too much detail in the Bill of Rights, to leave it to the assembly to provide for the necessary procedures and mechanisms, but nevertheless to guarantee to victims the opportunity to assert the rights that they are already guaranteed in the Constitution, but now to give them an effective way to do that. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Are there questions of Mr. Shepherd? And Ms. Meyer, your name was being invoked. Did you have anything to offer in this, or is it useful to get you a
Chairman McPherson,
here?
Members of the committee, Andrew Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. Pete, being a very good lawyer, is trying to be clear, but let me be clear. The ACLU supports these amendments, as I testified to some of our concerns, being not putting too much detail into the Constitution and leaving for the legislature to make those decisions. We were part of the work group. We signed off on these amendments.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you very much. So we are in work session on both House Joint Resolution 49 and H.J.R. 50. Do I hear a motion? We should take those separately. Together.
You want to do it separately?
Yeah, I think so.
Mr. Chair, move H.J.R. 49 and 4 to be passed.
Actually, we need the -3 amendment.
-3 into H.J.R. 49.
Representative Barker moves the -3 amendments into House Joint Resolution 49. Any discussion? Any objection? -3 amendments are in. bring it to the floor.
Mr. Chair, move HGR 49 to the floor with a new pass.
Representative Barker moves House Joint Resolution 49 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? If not, the clerk call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Winston?
Aye.
Chairman
Aye. House Joint Resolution 49 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash 4s in HGR 50.
Representative Barker moves the dash 4 amendments into House Joint Resolution 50. Is there any objection? Any discussion? Any objection? Dash 4 amendments are in the resolution.
Mr. Chair, move House Joint Resolution 50 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Joint Resolution 50 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Vice
Aye. And the chair will carry both HGR 49 and HGR 50 on the floor. Thank you very much. We'll close the work sessions on HJR 49, HJR 50. I think heading in order through our later work session here, House Bill 2014. I'll open a work session on HB 2014.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2014 comes to you from Representative Barnhart. Authorize legislative assembly members to solemnize marriages, restricts legislative members from charging accepting payment for solemnization of marriages. You have the dash 3 amendments, which adds county and municipal executives to the list of officials authorized to solemnize marriages, prohibits a person who is a member of a governing body, a county, or a mayor, or a member of the legislative assembly from charging a fee unless the person is a clergy person, and solemnizing a marriage in the person's private capacity declares emergency, making it effective upon passage.
As you may recall, is Representative Barnhart's bill, and I don't see him here, so I'm not sure we have it. Is there anybody here who is on behalf of Representative Barnhart?
Would anybody like to be married this morning?
Mr. Chair, Representative, I actually recommended this bill and what was going to for the Turkey Award.
Okay. I don't know. I didn't get that.
Well, committee, we had these technical changes offered up in the dash 3 amendments and the addition of an emergency clause, which would put our members good to go for the summer wedding season, assuming we're not still hanging around in this building. Representative Krieger.
Every job I get, there's no pay.
Did anything in the dash 3 amendments change it? My question was, is it okay if we say no? I just want to make sure we can still do that.
I think we're still, it's purely authority. I think we're not bound to bound to serve.
Mr. Chair. Representative Cameron.
I'll be a no on this for one reason I mentioned in the work session or in the public hearing, but also I'm concerned that as legislators we are making the law and the laws of marriage, and that we will also be implementing the laws, and right now I think that's kind of restricted to a separate branch of the government and people that are out there licensed to be able to do that. So I will be a no on this today.
Very good. Representative Flores.
Mr. Chair, to quote the words of Representative Barnhart as he brought him to us, it is a well-understood fiction that a number of people have become matchbox ministers, and I'm not anxious, nor do I have a desire to become one of those, so I will be voting no on this bill. And secondly, I guess, once again, I failed to see that this rises to the level of a public policy emergency for the emergency clause. So I just have some serious apprehension about this particular bill. So I will be voting no. Thank you.
Very good. Senator Krieger.
I think likewise.
Any further discussion? I guess we have, the question is there enthusiasm for moving forward with this? I think that none of us would regard this as being an important public policy development. It's a question of whether there is enough downside to make it not worth undertaking the effort. Any other thoughts?
Well, Mr. Chair, if I might just add, perhaps the downside is that the public does look to us, and we have committed to restore some confidence and credibility in the legislature. I'm not sure this kind of adds to that package. So, thank you.
Comments well taken. Any other thoughts?
Mr. Chair, I don't really have strong feelings one way or the other on this. I know Representative Barnhart does. That's why he brought the bill. And I think if people are uncomfortable with it, they can just decline to perform the marriage.
Well, it's going to have to summon sufficient enthusiasm on somebody's part to move the dash to amendments.
Dash three
amendments, I beg your pardon. I'm not hearing a motion. Well, if it doesn't draw that level of enthusiasm within the committee, then I am going to close the work session on House Bill 2014.
I do.
I do. Okay, I'll open a work session on House Bill 2329.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2329 has a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee. The dash four amendments in front of you increases the sentence from 19 to 27 months for certain property offenses and increases the sentence from 13 to 18 months for other property offenses. It also sets forth some changes in the AIP program and also increases the funding level for AIP treatment and drug treatment in the correction system. I know Bradbury from the Oregon District Attorney's Association is here, as is Scott Taylor, and I think they'd like to point something out in the amendments if you have time to hear from them. They just spoke to me just before that.
Yes. Barry, if you could come forward.
And Scott Taylor.
Yeah. Scott Taylor, please.
I also see Joe, Craig Prinz and Joe O'Leary, who worked on the bills, too, are in the audience.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, I'm Brad Berry, Yamhill County District Attorney, and representing the Oregon District Attorneys Association. Actually, I had spoke with Mr. Taylor beforehand on an inconsistency I saw in the dash fours, but after discussing it further with Mr. Taylor and Mr. Prinz, I'm not sure that it actually exists. So that was my concern that I'd mentioned, and I think we've got that worked out. There may be a little language issue that we can work on later, but it will take some further discussion. As you may recall, this was originally brokered through Criminal Justice Commission, Department of Corrections, and the District Attorneys Association for this kind of large piece and compromise of our positions. So the language has been important, and it still may need a little tweaking. But I don't think we need to discuss that further today, just because, like, I was under a misimpression that both Mr. Taylor and Mr. Prinz have corrected me on.
Okay. Mr. Taylor, do you have comments to offer?
Chairman Pearson, committee. Scott, for the record, Scott Taylor, Chief of Community Corrections, Oregon Department of Corrections, and Mr. Berry has said it succinctly.
Very good. Representative Bonamici.
I don't have a question for the people who are here, but more of a procedural question. Did you say, are we referring to, is the motion referred to Ways and Means?
It will be, as a subsequent to Ways and Means.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure we were talking about that, because when I was trying to get a handle on the price tag on this.
Right. Committee, you should understand there's a major price tag on this proposal. And this is, in Chair's view, a well-crafted proposal, but it is an expensive proposal.
Yeah.
And so it will be part of then a very, I think, focused analysis of those, the elements of cost, and whether there may be other offsetting cost reductions that might be paired up with it too, because of the impacts that we're looking at here. So there's clearly a large fiscal dimension to it, but I think we should be focusing ourselves on the policy issues in the repeat property offenses and the alternative incarceration program, and then move this to the next stage of what's going to be a larger discussion. Representative Krieger.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I agree in trying to quantify savings, which I think there will be some long-term. Some of the expenses of this are long-term also, not in this biennium necessarily, but the policy issue I think is sound.
Representative Wisner.
When we had testimony on this, Crime Victims United was not happy with the jail reduction time. Is that, were they part of negotiations on the Dash 4?
Nodding heads. I see nodding heads back in the audience. And if you need anything more on that, Representative Wisner.
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
We also had presented to us Dash 5 amendments, which include an accountability mechanism into this bill and the discussion around AIP. Are we giving, I would hope that we're giving further consideration to that. I'm looking for your direction.
And I think that the Dash 5s are not part of the consensus that was formed around the Dash 4s to move this forward, so it would not be my thought that we should be moving those. I think.
So there is no consensus around accountability in the AIP program?
I think that there is a consensus that around changes that ought to be made to the AIP, which I think you could in the form of the Dash 4s, which you could, I think, characterize as being part of an accountability effort. I think it's a question of different strategies, and there are different proposals that are coming forward, but it is the Dash 4s that represent the concerted work of the key stakeholders. Any further discussion?
We have, I didn't see a Dash 5, but we have...
So the last meeting, and that should be in the packet this morning, too.
Mr. Chair, you need a motion to adopt the Dash 4 amendments?
We need a motion on the Dash 4, Representative Cameron.
Okay. I'll move the Dash 4s be adopted into House Bill 2329.
Representative Cameron moves the Dash 4 amendments into House Bill 2329. Is there any discussion? Any objection? And the Dash 4 amendments are in the bill.
Looking for the Dash 5s.
You want to borrow mine?
Oh, yeah.
And so the chair would entertain a motion to move House Bill 2329 due pass as amended to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2329 as amended to Ways and Means Public Safety or Ways and Means.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2329 as amended with a due pass recommendation to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Representative Wisner, to you.
Mr. Chair, thank you. I don't see any problem, Mr. Chair, in Dash 5 as part of, like, follows up with SB 267. I don't see why we wouldn't include the Dash 5. It doesn't. If we're going to spend all this much money, I'm sure we're going to monitor and have some accountability.
Just a comment on the Dash 5s. I think I made that point that it's got 5 years as recidivism measurement, and currently everything that I see in Ways and Means that we measure is 3 years. And Representative Thatcher said she wouldn't mind, I mean, if we had to change that, but I know that was... Certainly, I can't remember where my notes were, but that was certainly something that might be a conflict in the measurement of how we were going about doing that.
And I would offer the observation, too, that we're already, with the Dash 4s, looking at a bill that's got a substantial price tag, and I see in the Dash 5s an annual performance audit by the Secretary of State's office, which is probably not huge in relation to the underlying cost, but it is that much larger a nut to crack for our colleagues in Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair, Representative Wisman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. But again, if we're spending all this much money, you know, maybe we don't do annual, but we're biannual or whatever, but we're spending, proposing as a policy that we're going to spend all this much money, we should probably be looking at being sure it's being spent effectively.
Other Representative Kump.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. It's an interesting dilemma we're kind of breaching into, because when we ask people to come together and reach a consensus agreement, then I would really like to see us move this bill with the dash fours and make sure that we, well, frequently as things are proceed, whether there's broader discussion over on the Senate side about how are these funds going to be held accountable, and it's just, I'd hate to stop a process that's already reached some consensus agreements on.
Well, and I would offer the observation too that it's a consensus at this policy stage. This is still a work in progress. Mm-hmm. This is not the last that this bill is going to be attended to. In fact, it would probably get even more intense review and dissection because of the budget implications. And there will be plenty of opportunity for the policymakers in this building to look at accountability issues and what kind of oversight of both the repeat property offender and AIP components.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Could Mr. O'Leary confirm with us that this comes under Senate Bill 267 and would be?
Mr. O'Leary. Members of the committee, good morning. For the record, Joe O'Leary, Senior Policy Advisor to Governor Kulongoski. Representative Wisnett, to answer your question, it does come under Senate Bill 267. I'd also like to refresh the committee's memory from the public hearing in which Director Williams of the Department of Corrections testified, and I just confirmed with Mr. Taylor that the department does intend to scrutinize, if this bill is measures passed, scrutinize these programs and do performance evaluations and report regularly to this body in cooperation with the Criminal Justice Commission.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr.
Any further discussion?
So is it...
Yeah. I'm sorry.
Are we still on the dash four?
The dash four amendments are in the bill. We are in discussion on the bill as amended, and we could hear. I think we did not take a motion yet.
No.
To move it as amended, but that motion would be in order.
Before I make that motion, I just want to make sure Representative Wisnett is satisfied with that. Or
yes, sir.
You're fine. Okay. So I'll
Mr. Chair, as long as there's someone, you know, monitoring expenditure of this funds, and that comes under Senate Bill 267, I'm sure the Department of Corrections will report to the legislative body on that.
Mr. Chair, I'll move House Bill 2329 as amended to, are we going to Ways and Means with this?
Yes.
To Ways and Means with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Cameron moves House Bill 2329 as amended with the due pass recommendation to be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means for prior reference. Any discussion of that motion? Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We had a lot of testimony about this bill, and I think there's a lot of very meritorious parts of it, and I'm going to support it. I just want us to keep in mind that it is a very expensive proposal, and yes, that investing in treatment is going to save money down the long run, but so is investing in prevention. So I want to again mention that let's not lose sight of preventing before crimes are committed, whether that's through funding Head Start or strengthening our public schools to keep kids in school and stronger families and living wage jobs and all the things that will prevent crime we need to focus on as well. So I'm going to support this bill. I know it has a big price tag, and I hope that at least some of it gets funded, if not all of it, and that it actually pays off in the long run. Thank you.
Senator Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I support this bill, and I support the AIP process. I think it's a wonderful program. My concern about the accountability mechanism, while I understand the Department of Corrections will be self-monitoring, benchmarking, and reporting, that's very important as well. I think in terms of long-term study, it's sometimes also helpful to have an outside independent review, and that was kind of the thrust of my concern. As we looked at the alternative to not only the agency monitoring and accounting for itself, but also an outside independent analysis of the process and the progress being had. But I think AIP has significant merit, and I will support this bill.
Thank you, Representative. If there's no further discussion, we have a motion before us to move House Bill 2329 as amended by the Dash 4s with a due pass recommendation and on to Ways and Means. The clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye. So the House Bill 2329 is amended, moves to the Committee on Ways and Means. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2329 and open a work session on House Bill 2667.
Mr. Chair, members of the Committee, House Bill 2667 comes to you at the request of the Office of the Public Defense Services. It eliminates the provision that requires a Court of Appeals judge to review a petition filed by a person under the jurisdiction of the State Board of Parole and Post-Prison Supervision, contesting the board's decision prior to review by the Court of Appeals. Becky Duncan is here from the State Public Defender's Office. You have the Dash 1 amendments in front of you, which simply changes the reference over in page 2, line 37, from the Office of Public Defense Services to the Public Defense Services Commission. Chair, members of the committee, I believe one of the questions of the last meeting way back in February was where the courts stand on this, and I think that the courts are okay with this. At least that's what I was told.
That's correct.
Could you done?
I'm sorry, go ahead.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee and council, the Court of Appeals does support this bill and has drafted a letter of support which was circulated to the members of this committee. They join the Office of Public Defense Services in asking for your support of House Bill 2667, which would streamline the appeal process in parole cases by eliminating a motion practice, which is required in every case, but leaving the possibility that motions be filed in appropriate cases. We believe that this would make the process more efficient and thereby reduce costs and eliminate unnecessary delays in parole cases.
And you didn't need to identify yourself for the record.
I'm sorry. Becky Duncan for the Office of Public Defense Services.
Any further questions about this bill or comments? We have the Dash 1 amendments at your meeting.
Office to that.
Certainly.
Yeah, just a minor wording change in the Dash 1 amendments. Everybody understanding what's going on here?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. We, in our looking back at this bill, we had concern by the Real Estate Commission. Is that true, or has that been resolved? I might be wrong.
It's 2667 on public defense services.
This is one where they have to file a brief every time, and if they didn't have to file a brief, like two-thirds of the cases, they were doing a duplication of effort. I think everybody
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker, I can provide a quick summary if that will help refresh everyone's memory. What this bill does primarily is eliminate a requirement that in every parole appeal, before filing a brief, our office has to file a motion for leave to proceed, asking the court for permission to go forward. The Attorney General, who represents the Board of Parole, is forced to respond to that motion, and then the court has to decide that motion. All of that has to happen currently in every case before the case is received to briefing. That causes
causes on average a delay of 4 months in every case, and the majority of these cases, the motion is granted and the cases proceed to briefing. What this bill does is eliminate the requirement that the motion be filed in every case, but preserve the option that an equivalent motion be filed in appropriate cases, so that if a case should not proceed to briefing, there is a mechanism for the board to file a motion and for the court to say that the case should not proceed to briefing. So what this bill does is preserve all of the efficiencies from the current system, eliminate the unnecessary time and effort spent on motions that are going to be granted anyhow, and it streamlines the process. The Board of Parole is neutral on this bill. The court, which must review and decide these motions, support it, and our office, which also must litigate it, supports this bill.
Thank you, Duncan. Thank you, Ms. Duncan. Committee, this is just a procedural, eliminating a procedural hoop. It is making it possible with more greater efficiency to proceed through other
cases. And Mr. Chair, as I recall, about two-thirds of the cases don't need this, and so this will be helpful there. And if you're ready, are we in work session?
We are in work session.
I move the dash ones into House Bill 2667.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2667. Any discussion? Any objection? And the dash one amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, move House Bill 2667 to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2667 to the floor with a due pass recommendation as amended. And is there any discussion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Trump.
Aye.
Representative Krieger.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair Whitman.
Aye.
Chair McPherson.
Aye.
2667 moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation, and I'm wondering whether the consent calendar would be reasonable for this. Looking to you, Representative Flores, since you tend to be the advocate for a fuller discussion on the floor.
Does it take more than 2 or 3 minutes to say what something is doing when it's making an adjustment? I think maybe a little discussion to inform our colleagues might be helpful.
Okay, you realize what I may ask in response to that?
Yes, I do, and yes, I will.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Flores. Just continuing down the backside of our agenda, we're at House Bill 2833. Council Sayre.
Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2833 comes to you from Representative Barker and Representative Kotek, establishes a actually, looking to the dash two amendments, basically replaces a bill, allows a public safety officer at the time he or she is hired to designate a beneficiary to receive benefits from the Public Safety Memorial Fund, allows a person designated as a beneficiary to receive benefits from the fund, allows a family member or parent to receive benefits if no beneficiary is designated, expands the definition of child to include a person 18 to 22 under certain circumstances rather than the current 19. Chair, members of the committee, you have before you the dash two amendments, and needless to say, Representative Barker knows this bill a lot better than I do. Yeah.
And I might say that although we did have a public hearing on this before, it was just a tap in and tap out. So we really haven't had a presentation on this bill. So, Representative Barker, if you could maybe take a little more
Thank
time.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this bill is about, the public safety people in the state, if they get killed in the line of duty, there's a fund that pays. And the way it was set up before is that it would either pay to the spouse or child or to the parents. And there was there are cases where people would like to leave it to somebody else, and so this allows the employee to designate the beneficiary on these with some restrictions, but that was the main thrust to this. And for example, at the time when my mother was around 100 years old, had I been killed while on duty, she didn't need the money, but I had a sister that could have used it, and under the current law, if I hadn't been married, it would have gone to my mother, and this would allow me to designate to my sister.
This bill has to go over. And the give us a little fuller background, Representative Barker, on the Public Safety Memorial Fund. That's where the dollars come from to support the benefits, what the nature of the benefits are.
The nature of the benefits, Mr. Lashman's here. I know they would, what they do, they try to help somebody get over and keep the rules away from the door. They pay, there's a cash settlement, I think, of $25,000, and then they pay mortgage payments for 12 months, and then they will pay, there's money for college for the children and health insurance.
Mr. Lashman, yeah, why don't you add a little more detail there? Is that
Mr. Chair, Representative Barker is exactly on target. This fund was established, I think, and the sessions are running together, but I think it was four sessions ago, may have been five sessions ago. It came from then-Representative Westland, and it was a response to several state troopers at the time, one down in the Codfelder case down labeled as Klamath Falls, in which there was basically no initial response either through insurance or any other form to assist the family for the immediate expenses of burial and getting on a stable footing. So this fund was established through uniform fines and assessments. There's some of that money goes to this. It's placed in a fund that's controlled by the DPSST board. As Representative Barker has indicated, there are a number of functions. One is immediate payment to within 7 days to the family member. In most cases, it's the spouse. It could be the parent. It also allows for some health insurance if you have minor children and the employer or former employer is not willing to pick up that insurance for a time period. And it also allows for some college education in the cases of dependent children. This amendment, this bill, just allows for an additional option. As Representative Barker has said, you may be unmarried, you may have a sister who's disabled that you want to designate. It just allows that flexibility in the cases where that individual wants to make that choice.
Mr. Chair, so I understand, what I just put this in my will, if I was a public safety officer that was unmarried, to say this is where I want it, or what I designated on a form.
Representative McPherson, Representative Cameron, yes, you would put it into a specific form, and the form would be provided.
Follow up, if I may.
I think it's a state form.
Representative Cameron.
Yeah. Is there any restrictions at all? Could I name just my best friend next door on that particular form?
It's my understanding with these amendments that would be a possibility, but again, the intent here is to get some liquid cash to somebody to take care of the funeral expenses and the immediate living needs of someone who's dependent upon that wage earner.
Thank you.
Mr. Lashman, how's it funded? Where's the money come from?
Again, it comes from the uniform fines and assessments. There is a small portion of that goes to this fund historically.
So in other words, if somebody has a criminal fine or a traffic violation, there's some portion of that.
Very small portion of that, Mr. Chair, goes into a fund that's established and controlled by the DPSSD board. That board then has the ability to distribute those dollars in those rare cases, and hopefully even rarer cases, in which a public safety officer, a police officer, a corrections officer, or a firefighter is killed in the line of duty. In the line of duty is the key. It's not, you have a firefighter who has died unrelated and he's been retired for 30 years, they pay this. This is in the line of duty.
And how does the fund compare with the obligations? That is there more flowing into it from those criminal fines and assessments than the need, or and are we? I mean, this is a pretty modest expansion of the eligibility for the benefit. But are we creating an obligation by having the fund and by expanding its eligibility rules, creating a situation where there'd be more call on the fund than there are resources?
Mr. Chair, actually, DPSST representative is here. I know that historically we look at this fund to make sure that we believe it's sufficient. But again, keeping in mind, we have no idea whether or not you're going to have a catastrophe in which you're going to lose four or five firefighters in a fire, and the fund, in fact, is going to be minimal, or whether or not you're going to go a number of years like we have at a couple of times in which there is no public safety officers that have done that, and that money, in fact, then carries over and is in the fund. But it's our view that the fund up to this point has been sufficient to handle these needs, and this expansion doesn't do anything other than if you have a loss, then, in fact, that obligation to pay is to somebody that they designate rather than doesn't go anywhere or doesn't go to the place they want it to go to.
Chair McPherson, for the record, Marilyn Lawrence with the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training. I oversee the Standards and Certification Program, which is the section of the department that administers the Public Safety Memorial Fund. And just to clarify, the department in its analysis of these Dash 2 amendments does not view this as an expansion of the program at all. We budget for the particular lump sum payments to a designee, and right now, statutorily, that beneficiary would be a spouse, dependent children, or a parent. What this bill does is simply provide an alternative designee. It does not add a designee, so there really is no increase to the program at all.
So what would happen under current law if a person that was childless, unmarried, they had no one within that range of beneficiaries, what would there be a benefit paid to their estate?
Representative McPherson, there is no provision for payment to be made to an estate. However, in my experience with the Public Safety Memorial Fund, there has not been a case where there has not been a beneficiary under the standard designation of beneficiaries that exists currently. And that standard designation would not go away under this bill. There would simply be an alternative process that a public safety officer could use if that officer wished to designate a beneficiary other than the standard list that reflects the federal program.
Very good.
Just two comments. I hope the fund grows infinitely.
As do we.
That we never have to use it. This is a great bill to help our public safety people that put their lives on the line every day. It's great. Representative Barker, thanks for bringing it forward.
All right. And Mr. Chair, when they had the tragic death of the firefighters down in Coos Bay a few years ago, I believe there was 9 children that would then be covered. And so those are the kind of things that are very helpful. And it's aimed primarily for the line officers, both fire service and police service. So it's mostly younger people with the children, and this will help them.
Mr. Chair, if I may, too, one additional clarification. The only modification that's been done on this that I've seen over the life of this was that once Oregon implemented this a number of years ago, actually the feds decided this was a pretty good idea. And there is a parallel college fund that is established at the federal level for dependent children. And we came back and said, okay, if the feds are going to pay for the college, then, and we don't have to, we'll delete that. If the feds don't pay for the college, we'll still pay for it. But if the feds are going to pay for the college, we'll delete that from the dependent children's benefit, but we'll allow them a couple years of graduate school instead if they choose to do that. So we are very closely monitoring this fund to make sure that it, in fact, meshes with the federal programs and we maximize our dollars.
Very good. Any further questions or discussion? Representative Flores.
Just a comment, Mr. Chair, and thank you. I really appreciate the work that you've done on this bill. I think it is a good approach, and I appreciate the approach that you've taken to make this a by designation. I think that's a very responsible way to have gone about the whole looming debate. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Representative Flores.
Very good. Then I think we're ready for a motion on the Dash 2.
Chair, I move the Dash 2s into House Bill 2833.
Representative Barker moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2833. Any discussion? Any objection? The Dash 2 amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2833 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2833 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of that motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Cameron. Yes. Representative Flores. Aye. Representative Cameron. 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 Aye.
House Bill 2833 moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and Representative Barker will ask you to carry that.
Thank you.
Close the work session on House Bill 2833. We're not going to be opening a work session on House Bill 3420, but I'm going to ask Council Taylor to update us so you'll...
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3420 would direct Secretary of State to conduct audits of county juvenile programs. That's actually current law. One of the things that arose after the last hearing, we have a set of amendments before us that would reduce the number of audits. And the Secretary of State, I believe Mr. Hibner mentioned that they would assume the responsibility with current staffing. After I got through the meeting, I received an email from LFO citing an AG's opinion concerning the fact that they have to charge, and by statute. So I've been working with Pete Shepard on that issue yesterday of about changing that statute so they wouldn't have to charge. And then after going through those discussions, I had discussions with Mr. Hibner about the fact that that may cause them problems with the feds as it relates to other programs. And I just think that we need, and the other thing is, I talked late last night to Mr. Dole. He's not here today. He tells me his father's in the hospital. So I'd like just additional chance, if I could, to sit down with the interested parties and at least find out more about what may be able to be done in this bill. It has a prior referral to the Ways and Means Committee, and we assume that if the Secretary of State was going to assume the cost, it wouldn't need a prior referral to Ways and Means Committee, and that could be removed. We're not sure right now.
Very good. So we will roll over the work session on House Bill 3420 to next day's agenda. So let's see if it's ready to be worked then.
Well, Chair,
Representative Wisner.
Thank you for that. And I'd like to point out that a lot of members of this committee are on sponsorship for this, but we will bring it back for work session.
That's certainly our expectation. We'll next open a work session on House Bill 3084.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 3084 was heard by this committee on April 17th. It's the bill that increases to $10,000 the maximum amount that a plaintiff may seek in tort actions in which the court is required to award attorney's fees if the plaintiff provides the defendant or its insurer a written demand for payment at least 10 days before the action is initiated. The bill also defines the demand requirement with a little more specificity. It states that it must include either a copy of the plaintiff's medical records and bills or documentation of the amount of damages to property depending on the circumstances. And the bill also repeals the provision that requires a court to award attorney fees to a prevailing defendant if the defendant had pleaded a counterclaim.
Committee, this bill raises re-raises, I suppose, maybe the way to express it, a policy choice that has been made in the past by the Legislative Assembly, which is that a mechanism for creating greater incentive for settlement or resolution of small tort claims, that there is a very small ones, up to an amount of $5,500, that there's an attorney's fees opportunity for the can be awarded in the case as a, because the attorney's fees become so significant in relation to the amount that's at issue. The proposal is to increase that from $5,500 to $10,000. When we had this bill before us before, as I recall, there was some resistance within the committee, which I think went more not to the question of whether we should be raising the amount, but maybe discomfort with the underlying policy choice. So I wanted to bring it back and air that more fully with the committee. It would seem to the chair that if the prior policy choice is sound, moving it from $5,500 to $10,000, it has not been raised since I think it was the 1999 session.
Right.
It's about inflation. I mean, and there's no inflation escalator in it, so by the time it would be revisited again, it's going to be it will doubtless fall behind inflation from the previous policy choice. And I would have to say that when you're talking about damages in a in any kind of tort action, those are pretty small dollars in relation to the cost of attorney time in dealing with these claims. So there are, I think it's sort of presents to us again maybe the policy choice of the underlying statute.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Bonamici.
One of the issues that was raised in the public hearing was that some attorneys were actually sending the demand without the background information. the documentation. And I was, I guess, sort of wishful thinking, hoping that everybody could go work that part out to make it more of a trade-off. And apparently that hasn't happened. Because it seems that if that's part of the problem, that the demand letter sent without the documentation, which was another intent of this bill, was to make sure that when the demand is sent, that there's at least some written documentation of the injuries and the amount of the damage, is the way I understood it. So I guess nobody went in and worked on that, and so I think we need to consider that part of the bill as well as the increase, is that it does require a copy of medical records and bills as part of the demand.
Representative Krieger.
Mr. Chair, raising that threshold to that point may sound like it's taking inflation into consideration, but because it can be done through a demand letter, it's really just a way of, without going through a real good process in my mind, of extorting more money. I'm not going to be supporting the bill.
I have some of the same concerns, Mr. Chair. I'm trying to support bills where people they've come before us, and then the groups go out and come up with a compromise that seems to work. And this one just didn't get there, and I'm not going to be able to support it today either.
Well, we're in open and work session. There'll have to be somebody's going to have to take up the advocacy for this bill. If it's going to
Mr.
move
Chair,
forward.
That would not be me.
you would have startled me if you'd Representative Flores. Then, and not hearing any motion on House Bill 3084, I'm going to close the work session on that bill. House Bill 2774. Open a work session on House Bill 2774.
On that last bill, I didn't know if I was supposed to.
We were in work session rather than public hearing, and so I'm afraid that there was insufficient enthusiasm for the bill to move the bill. So it would be for another day.
Chair McPherson, members of the committee, House Bill 2774 relates to ignition interlock devices. We previously had a hearing on April 16th, and there were a couple of amendments. Let me explain what the bill does in its present form. As we know, ignition interlock devices attach to a car's ignition system. When installed, the driver is required to blow into the device before starting the vehicle. If the device detects alcohol, the vehicle will not start. Ignition interlock devices have been used in several states since at least the 1990s. ORS 813.602 requires ignition interlock devices for persons convicted of driving under the influence of intoxicants, or DUI, in Oregon for the six-month period after the person's license is suspended. So after you get not diversion, because diversion does not count as a conviction, but after you pick up a DUI conviction, your license would be suspended for a one-year period. Oregon law would then require, after that one-year suspension period, you have an additional 6 months where you have to use the ignition interlock device. Violation of this condition is a Class A traffic violation. If a person fails to submit proof that they've installed an interlock, the person's license remains suspended until either the state receives proof of the installation or until 6 months after the suspension. Essentially what that means is the person's license continues to be suspended then for the same time period that the person should have been able to drive, but only with the ignition interlock device. So it's effectively an 18-month suspension rather than just a 12-month if you would have done what you were supposed to do. House Bill 2774 changes these rules in some way, and what I'm talking about is the Dash 2 Amendment. For your first DUI, the interlock installation is for 1 year, not 6 months, after the ending date of the license suspension caused by the conviction. For a second or subsequent DUI, the interlock installation is for 2 years after the ending date of the license suspension caused by the conviction. Violation of these conditions remains a Class A traffic violation. The Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2774 clarify that a person convicted of DUI who fails to submit proof of an interlock ignition or the ignition interlock installation, that person would continue to have their license suspended not for 6 months, but for 1 year, for the first conviction or for 2 years for the second or subsequent conviction.
I don't have any subsequent. No.
Okay. And is there anything? Yeah, counsel, is there anything about the implementation of the dash twos as compared to the original printed bill that would warrant ways and means consideration?
Chair McPherson, well, I'm going to compare it because this appears to have been a gut and stuff. So I'm going to compare it to the dash, compared to the dash ones.
Right. Okay. Very good.
There is nothing in the dash twos. It's a longer suspension period. That is all.
Okay. Very good.
Mr. Chair, I just would point out that this was brought to us by Representative Shields, and he works with a lot of recovering addicts and alcoholics in his trying to help people get back on the road. So I think he put some thought into that before he brought this before us.
Right.
Chair.
Representative Wisnett.
Thank you. I think it's a great bill, but I'm concerned that I don't remember, did we have state police say they're willing to do it and take it out of their hide? Is this...
The person pays for it. The drunk driver pays for everything.
For all the truck, for the...
For the machine and for the rental. And
yeah, I know, for the equipment, but for setting up the program or something. Is there not going to be any impact on state police?
Representative Wisnett, effectively, the program is in place now.
Okay.
Right now, they're supposed to be doing this for just a six-month period. That is current Oregon law.
Okay.
What this bill says is 6 months isn't enough. You need to have this for a year on your first conviction. You need to have it for 2 years on your second or subsequent.
Thank you, Mr. Clarification.
Sure.
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the dash two amendments to House Bill 2774.
Representative Bonamici moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2774. Any discussion, Representative Kahn?
Just a quick question. As Representative Barker pointed out, Representative Shield brought this bill forward. Are the dash twos what he's, is that his recommendation then?
Chairman Pearson, Representative Comp, I can't say that I've spoken directly. I've spoken indirectly with Representative Shields and folks in his office about this bill and about the dash twos. And I have every reason to believe the answer to that is yes.
Thank you. That's all I want to know.
Yeah. And I should, for clarification on that, I've also, Representative Shields worked with the Pratts, and I've spoken with the Pratts about the dash two amendment, and they're
okay.
Pleased with it.
So. Thank you.
We have a motion before us to adopt the dash two amendments. Any further discussion?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
I just wanted to, in connection with this bill, which I see as a prevention bill, which I support, I get emails from the Washington County Sheriff. They do a informative emails about what's going on in the county. And this morning, before I came here, two came in. One of them was a crash on Northwest Union, which is in my district. Life-threatening injuries. It does appear that alcohol was a contributing factor. The second one was another serious injury accident at the intersection of Northwest Cornell. One man has been detained on suspicion of DUI and reckless driving. So that was two just this morning before I came to this committee. So I see a bill like this as a way to prevent, if we could have prevented these people from getting behind the wheel, that would have been a good thing.
Very good. Is there any further discussion of the motion to move the dash two amendments? Is there any objection to the dash two amendments? The dash two amendments are in the bill.
I move House Bill 2774 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Bonamici moves House Bill 2774 as amended by the dash two amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll. Bonamici.
Aye.
Gorbun.
Aye.
Aye.
Representative Kahn?
Aye.
Representative Krieger?
Aye.
Representative
Reese?
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Wisnett?
Aye.
Chair McClinton?
Aye. House Bill 2774 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation, and we'll offer that to Representative Shields to carry, but if he declines, Representative Bonamici, would you carry it?
Thank you.
Very good. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2774. And we'll go back to the front page on our agenda and start from the bottom on House Bill 2448. Open a work session on House Bill 2448.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. Members of the committee, House Bill 2448 is the bill that would extend the statute of limitations in Vioxx cases. There is a dash one amendment which states that the extension would only apply to causes of action arising on or before January 1st, 2007. What the intent of this amendment is, the reason for the bill, if I can just remind the committee, was there was a Supreme Court case that came out that said that there was no quote-unquote discovery rule in product liability actions in Oregon. And the legislature fixed that 2 years later, but there was a gap for certain individuals who were injured within that two-year gap. So what the amendment would do is cover those individuals who had not had their day in court because of the Gladhart decision. For injuries that arise after January 1st, 2007, it would be the normal two-year statute of limitations for products liability actions.
And committee, you may recall that the last time this bill was before us in work session, actually it failed on a vote to move the bill. And so I believe, and although I don't have a script for this purpose, that what we have to do initially is to suspend the rules to reconsider the vote on House Bill 2448.
Mr. Chair, I would move that we suspend the rules for the purposes of reconsidering House Bill 2448.
Representative Flores moves to suspend the rules for a reconsideration of the vote on House Bill 2448. Is there any discussion of that motion? Any objection? Then the rules are suspended. We can reconsider House Bill 2448.
Mr. Chair, it's my understanding with the dash ones that what this does is cover those people, some of whom came before us, the 50-some people, and then it stops there. So this will, the people who kind of fell into through the crack, we'll pick them up but not reopen it indefinitely.
Representative Barker, that's correct.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Bonamici.
That's my understanding as well, and we're talking about a narrow group of people who were in that period of time between the court decision and the time that the statute was changed, that the statute was not made retroactive. And plus, these drugs are taken off the market, so it's not like we have people continuing. So it's just a small group of people in that window. And as I said before, when we heard this bill, the insurance companies will still have, or the pharmaceutical companies will still have defenses available. This will just be the people they're going for.
Mr. Chair, also, I did oppose the bill in its prior form, but with the dash one amendments, it does restrict it so that this specific small class of individuals who were locked out could be to have their day in court and not move it beyond and open it up for an indefinite period. So I'm supportive of the dash ones should we choose to move them.
Very good. Well, we are in work session now, and we could I could entertain a motion to move the dash one amendments.
Mr. Chair, I move the dash ones into House Bill 2448.
Representative Barker moves the dash one amendments into House Bill 2448. Any discussion of the motion?
And just the other thing I'd like to say is I appreciate the effort that the parties made in bringing the dash ones forward as a compromise. So I'd like to.
Yeah, absolutely. Legislation is often improved by energies that people bring it to it in this process, and I think that's a clear example. Any further discussion of the motion on the amendments? Any objection to the dash one amendments to House Bill 2448? Hearing none, then the dash one amendments are in the bill.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2448 as amended to the floor with the due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2448 as amended to the floor with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the motion? Hearing none, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative
Bonamici. Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Representative Aye.
Aye.
Representative
Aye.
Vice Chair Barker.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Lisnett. Aye. Chair McPherson. Aye. House Bill 2448 as amended moves to the floor with the due pass recommendation, and I'd like to offer that to the Representative Smith and Representative Jensen, who are the original sponsors, but if they decline, Representative Lisnett, would you carry it then?
Thank you.
Very good. Thank you. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2448. And open a work session, House Bill 2310.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2310 was heard by this committee on April 17th, and the bill concerned the rights of judgment creditors who had a charging order against a limited liability company. And there was some the bill as originally drafted established a priority depending on the date of the charging order, and also established procedures for foreclosing on the charging order. There are dash one amendments before the committee, and essentially what the dash one amendments do is leave in the provisions relating to priority and take out everything else. So you would have priority based on when your charging order, they're the dash twos. Thank you, I'm being corrected. So the dash twos are all that's before the committee, not the dash ones, and it would leave in the provisions about priority and take out the rest.
This is, I think, a very minor bill in its impact, but it clarifies a technical piece of debtor-creditor law. And as I understand, this is this full consensus behind the bill. It is now from all those, and I see nodding heads here.
Including the Oregon State Bar.
Yes, in fact, David Niebel is nodding vigorously. It's from the bar.
Sorry, yeah.
Okay, then so do I hear a motion on the dash two amendments?
Mr. Chair, I move the dash twos into House Bill 2310.
Representative Barker moves the dash two amendments into House Bill 2310. Any discussion of that motion? Any objection? Dash two amendments are in.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2310 as amended to the floor with a due pass.
Representative Barker moves House Bill 2310 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion of the motion? If not, the clerk will call the roll.
Representative Bonamici.
Aye.
Representative Cameron.
Aye.
Representative Flores.
Aye.
Representative Hoff.
Aye.
Representative Peter.
Aye.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Vice Chair
Wisniewski. Aye.
Chairman Person.
Aye. House Bill 2310, as amended, moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. anybody enthusiastic about carrying this bill, or is there a feeling that this could go on the consent calendar? It's pretty technical in its subject matter.
Mr. Chair, you haven't carried for a while.
I stepped up to a constitutional amendment.
I'll chair it. I'll
very
carry
good. Actually, Representative Kump will carry House Bill 2310. Very good. Thank you, Representative.
Mr. Chair, I ask for permission to suspend the rules and change my vote on this. I haven't had a chance to read the dash two amendments, and so I'd like to change my vote if I could.
Very good. Representative Cameron moves to suspend the rules to permit him to change his vote from aye to nay, I assume. Well, I'll find out. To change his vote on House Bill 2310. Any discussion of that motion?
Mr. Chair, only if he doesn't ask me questions on the floor if it gets to the floor.
No, I'll leave that between the two of you. any objection to that motion? Then the rules are suspended. Representative Cameron, how do you vote?
No.
Okay. Let the record show a no vote from Representative Cameron.
And I probably should declare a conflict of interest is that I am a member in several LLCs.
You do get on the floor.
Okay.
So I think it is actually appropriate to declare, anytime we're taking action on a bill, even in committee, if we have an actual or potential conflict, it's our rules call for it to be announced.
Better to
thank
do
you.
It than not.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Close the work session on House Bill 2310. Stand at ease for a moment. Bill 2909. Council.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2909 is the bill that would establish that statutes of ultimate repose do not apply in product liability actions. The committee has heard a number of bills relating to statutes of ultimate repose and statute of limitations. But just to remind, the statute of ultimate repose is a period that cuts off the right to bring a lawsuit that is not dependent on when the injury arose, but is dependent on some other event such as when you purchase the product. There are a number of amendments before the committee. I will explain what each one does. The Dash 2 amendments would increase the test for repose to 14 years. It would apply to all product liability actions except those for which a civil action was commenced before the effective date of the act. The Dash 3 amendments clarify that the Dash 3 amendments are actually sort of a separate animal. They would clarify that statute of limitations and statute of repose for construction projects, the Dash 3 amendments would state that for manufactured dwellings and prefabricated structures, they would have the construction statute of repose and not the product liability statute of repose. So the Dash 3s are sort of a different policy choice than the rest. The Dash 5 amendments create a, quote, useful safe life standard for product liability actions. Essentially what that means is there would be a statute of repose based on the useful safe life of the product, which is defined as the date on which the product would not reasonably be expected to perform in a safe manner or could not reasonably be stored in a safe manner. The bill would also create a rebuttable presumption that the useful safe life of a product is 10 years, and a plaintiff would be able to overcome that presumption by showing by preponderance of the evidence that it was longer than 10 years. The Dash 5s also provide exceptions to the useful safe life statute of repose if A, the manufacturer or seller warrants that the product can be used for a longer period. B, the defendant intentionally misrepresents facts about the product and the misrepresentation is a cause of the injury. Or C, the injury was caused by exposure to a defective product during the useful safe life period but was not reasonably discoverable until after the useful safe life. And so that's a little bit complicated, but essentially the Dash 5 amendments would create a useful safe life standard. At 10 years, there would be a rebuttable presumption that the useful safe life of the product is 10 years, which the plaintiff could overcome by preponderance of the evidence. And then there would be these three exceptions, one being if the manufacturer warrants that it would be longer than the useful safe life, or if there's an intentional misrepresentation, or if the injury happened by exposure to a product during the safe life, but the injury wasn't discovered, didn't manifest itself until later. So those are the Dash 5s. Also before the committee are the Dash 7 amendments. What the Dash 7 amendments would do is maintain the current 10-year statute of repose. It would then establish the useful safe life standard for years 10 through 20 with the rebuttable presumption that I discussed before. So for years 10 through 20, the plaintiff would have to overcome a presumption that the useful safe life of the product has expired. And it would provide an absolute cap at 20 years. The bill does not revive extinguished causes of action.
Thank you, counsel. So, committee, we have essentially sort of a three-tier range of policy choices here, and then a separate item that is the Dash 3 amendments are not that they would if there's a change made in the statute of repose for product liability, then the Dash 3 amendments would be appropriate in combination with any of these sets of amendments because they. Make it clear that manufactured housing and prefabricated structures are treated as under the construction statute of repose at 10 years rather than under the product liability statute of repose. So I'll open it for discussion about those three tiers of amendment. In order to sort of shape the discussion, then the chair will move the Dash 5 amendments into House Bill 2909, and then we'll get that motion out on the table here for discussion within the committee.
Mr. Chair, I don't like the Dash 5s. I thought the Dash 2s were a good compromise, and that, again, as we've been talking about, and that's kind of where I was. That expands it some, but it isn't. I view the Dash 5 as a little bit open-ended. I mean, it's quite a leap from where we are today, and I'd rather start out with the Dash 2s.
Representative Bonamici.
Thank you. I have a couple of questions for counsel. I was intrigued by the useful life when we heard some testimony about it, and I recall that that's the standard that Washington has. So is either the Dash 5 or the Dash 7 amendments, are those based on Washington? And which one is most similar to Washington?
Thank you, Representative Bottomucci. The dash fives are the most similar to what Washington does.
Representative Wisnant.
Thank you. A couple of questions to follow up on that. I think we asked, and I looked real fast, that we asked the staff to tell us which states have tort liability or limits compared, and I think if Washington State does have some tort liability limits. Is that correct, Mr. Kim?
That is correct. Washington has no punitive damages, so that's okay.
You know, you have to look at the whole picture here of whether, and I would comment going back that the original bill that this committee looked at said we're going to do away with it completely, and as we've talked about in here, you know, compromise and looking at working things out for all parties, because all parties have an interest in this. This is not just one-sided. It affects tremendous important business in our state. So I could not support the dash five either.
Any further discussion?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know that this bill has had a tremendous amount of impact and information being processed. I will be giving the chair a courtesy yes on this vote, but reserve the right to change that vote on the floor. And yes, I agree very strongly with some of the statements we've made through other bills here this morning, that when people work in collaboration, we like to have those things recognized, and I hope this works out to that means.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
I have some concerns about the Dash 5 amendments, and I'm certainly not an expert in this field, but as I've been doing some homework, I'm not sure that they do provide the level of certainty that is hoped. I am supportive of the Dash 2s, which is an across-the-board four-year extension of the statute of ultimate repose, and would prefer to move the Dash 2s.
Further discussion? I'm wondering whether we have a sufficient consensus around one direction to go here.
I'd be willing to support the Dash 5s, but if there's not support in the committee, I would consider other approaches. The thing that concerns me about the Dash 2s is I just can't help thinking about those teachers from Lake Oswego, and I'm not sure that they would have their day in court under the Dash 2s.
Mr. Chair,
Representative Wisnant.
I move Dash 2 if we don't have a motion to.
Well, we have a motion before us on the Dash 5s.
Who made the motion?
I guess what I'm sensing is we don't have sufficient support for the Dash 5s, so I will withdraw that motion. And so we are in work session here now, and I think maybe what we need to do is to roll this, close the work session, roll this forward so that we can see where there may be a sufficient consensus forming around the
I still think there's consensus on Dash 2.
I agree.
Mr. Chair, I would support the Dash 2s.
So let's see.
Okay. We have so I hear a motion on the Dash 2 amendments. Is that right, Mr. Representative Wisnant?
Yes, sir.
Representative Wisnant moves the Dash 2 amendments into House Bill 2905. Is there a discussion of that motion? Representative Kopp.
Thank you, Chair McPherson. I would like to hear some testimony from the parties that are involved. If the work on the Dash 2s was a collaborative that they at one point had an agreement or... Yeah, I would just like to hear from the trial lawyers if they could support this bill.
Ms. Tressler, would it be helpful to hear?
And, Mr. Chair, while he's coming up, perhaps before we move to a vote on the Dash 2s, I'd like to at least have a brief mention of the Dash 7s as well, so we're making sure that we're being able to consider all those options.
Perhaps he can comment on that too.
Mr. Chairman, Alan Tressler, representing the Oregon Trial Lawyers Association. Representative Comp, we would not support the Dash 2 amendments. We do support the Dash 5 amendments. Dash 2 amendments are simple and straightforward. They're taking 8 years, which is an arbitrary number that this body picked a number of years ago, and replacing it with another arbitrary number that still does not assist those persons injured by a product. If it just happened to be, I mean, right now you get no relief if it's 8 years and 1 day, and under this bill, if you adopt those amendments, it'd be 12 years and 1 day, but you're still establishing an arbitrary number that does not give injured plaintiffs an opportunity to have their day in court, and that's what we're looking for, is that opportunity. That's why we believe the Dash 5s are fair. We do believe that remembering that the overwhelming majority of states in the United States have no statute of repose. It's infinity. Under the Dash 5 amendments, which are virtually identical to those used in Washington State, you do have a set period where there's a statute of repose, and the burden entirely shifts to the injured party after 10 years. But at least you have an opportunity to have your day in court. It certainly doesn't guarantee any kind of outcome, but it does give you the opportunity. There is no, in our viewpoint, there is no rational reason to establish an absolute arbitrary cutoff date from beyond which you have no cause of action, regardless the egregiousness of the injury. You'll recall at one point, I believe, that people testifying on this bill indicated to you the top 10 states in the United States that were good for business. What they didn't point out is virtually all of those states had no statute of repose whatsoever. So we don't believe there's any demonstrable evidence, linkage between what's good for business and a statute of repose. So we would not support the Dash 2 amendments, and we do support the Dash 5 amendments.
Mr. Chair. A couple of questions, if I may.
Go ahead.
I'm holding in my hands here the 2006 State Liability Systems Ranking Study, which finds Oregon 30th, Washington 28th, Idaho, our neighboring state, 18th. Mr. Tressider, if we were to pass this, do you think we would go up in those liability rankings for businesses, or would we go down?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, I don't think there's any relationship between what limitations there are on damages or access to the judicial system and what's good for business. I know that those rankings take a number of topics under consideration, and I can't imagine that changing our statute when we still are, there's only 25% of the states or less that even have a statute of repose is going to affect that ranking very much at all.
Thank you. And one more for me.
Go ahead.
You mentioned an arbitrary number. Is there a reason that the state of Oregon has an arbitrary number of a $200,000 liability limit if they were to injure somebody on a road in a state vehicle? Is there a reason we came up with that number?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cameron, no. That was an arbitrary. And in fact, last week there was substantial testimony in the Senate Judiciary Committee and testimony from the Oregon Health Sciences University, School Boards Association, Special Districts, League of Cities, and Association of Counties that those limits were artificially low, and all of those groups argued that those limits should be raised.
Okay.
Representative Kahn.
Chair, this is just a follow-up comment. I believe I certainly haven't previewed the film from some of our first hearings on this bill, but I think it was shared that this bill has been brought to us in other sessions and had not moved, and with that desire to make a change, make a recommendation to take some steps, I am over 50 years old and learned a few things in life that it's better to take some small steps and evaluate what's happened with that. And so this is a step forward to giving people a longer time to see product reliability, to add to some litigation, but keeping some fencing around it so we can review it if we need to next session.
What I might point out too, committee, is that there's we had three tiers of amendment here on the sort of substantive changes. We have the Dash 2s, which add more time, but still it's a bright line cutoff.
We have the dash fives, which say that at 10 years it shifts to a rebuttable presumption and then without any limit. And then we have the dash sevens, which are a 20-year end then, so you'd, which would be a compromise kind of approach within there. So what I would...
3 year.
So there are some choices here. Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's actually what I was going to ask. Mr. Trester's left now. If we could have a comment on the dash sevens as well.
Mr. Trester. And is there, we should be getting comments. Some of you are getting comments. We should be getting them from other stakeholders as well. And I would say.
I think Mr. Gardner has left. Mr. Chairman, Representative Reed, not too long ago, I was attempting to negotiate with the opponents to this bill and did offer up that we could, reluctantly, but could support the Dash 7 amendments, and that offer was rejected. And I would reluctantly repeat that offer that we could support the Dash 7 amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I'm sorry I don't have this particular document with me, Mr. Trezor, but there was a report that was referenced in some information I had from the United States House of Representatives, report number 109-728 from the 109th Congress. And it, on page 5 of the report, it states, among states having a product liability statute of repose, the clear consensus is that the period of repose should be 12 years or less. Now, if we were to address the Dash 2s, that would seem to put us in line with the recommendation from the United States Congress, House of Representatives, and put us in line with a national norm. And I see you indicating levels of disagreement. Can you give us some input on that?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, first, I'm not familiar with that report, so I don't know if that was a staff report, committee report, or the entire Congress. But I guess I would find difficulty in understanding how 12 years could be the norm when nearly 40 states have no statute of repose whatsoever.
And what I heard Representative Flores read was among those states that have a statute of repose.
Yes, so that's 10 states, effectively. And, I mean, and a number of those have a useful, safe life. Now, it may very well be that any product liability action in some of those states may be inside of that 12-year period. I don't have that statistic. But I know that the average, of those states that have a statute of repose of some kind, at least a third of those have a useful life standard. Oregon is the second shortest at 8 years. Only North Carolina, with courtesies to Chair, or to Representative Wisnett, only North Carolina has a shorter standard at 6 years.
A follow-up, please.
One, Representative Flores.
Thank you. In regard to the useful safe life standard, can you give me some your perspective or some input on how that would be determined for, let's say, if we were looking at a pharmaceutical product, the useful safe life of a prescription, let's say?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, it would be determined by a judge and a jury with the facts presented to them or at summary judgment motion. I mean, that would be a finding of fact for a fact maker to make. And I don't have at my disposal. I haven't heard the testimony. So I think it would depend upon the facts submitted before either a judge or a jury.
Follow up.
Go ahead.
Thank you. When I get a prescription, usually it says use by or expires at a certain date. Now, sometimes it's a year, rarely extends to 6 years, never is it indefinite. So I'm a little concerned about, you know, well, we'll just let a jury decide on something that's clearly indicating that its useful, safe life is determined by the pharmacy that's giving me the prescription.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I think if your prescription describes on it what the expiration date is, that that's probably prima facie evidence for the defendant to offer at a summary judgment, that you don't have a case here. We said this was good for until January 2009. This is now January 2011. you're dismissed, and that's the end of the issue. I mean, I think that is the defendant. The burden shifts. I mean, let me be really clear that in the Dash 5 amendment, that the burden shifts to the plaintiff to prove that was still inside of the useful safe life. And if your prescription says this expires on, I think you have a very high hurdle to overcome if you're an injured party. Very high hurdle.
Further follow-up?
Go ahead.
Thank you. Well, now if we're looking at equipment, I recall some discussion from the earlier hearing that the tragic incident of a young man and a tractor.
Yes.
Useful safe life of a tractor is?
30, 35 years maybe.
Or maybe 50 or?
Maybe. Farm equipment is historically used for a very long period of time, historically. Diesel engines, which most are operated by diesel engines, last 30 years sometimes. And so in this instance of Stephen Sharp, it was a tractor pulling a hay baler. It was a very old piece of equipment. However, it was a piece of equipment still being used in the manner in which it was designed to be used, had not been modified. I mean, the other thing about farm equipment is it lasts a long time because it lasts a long time. That's why farmers and people involved in agriculture and ranching invest large sums of money because they don't want to buy. It's not like an automobile. You don't buy one every 2 years. If you buy a $300,000 hay baler or more, you want it to last. And so in Mr. Sharp's case, he was using an old baler, but it was still being used in the manner for which it was designed. It hadn't been modified, and so I would argue, as he finally found relief in this home state of the manufacturer, that it was within its useful safe life.
Just an additional last follow-up. Thank you.
Okay.
And thank you for adding that. I thought that was a satisfactory recourse to go to the state of manufacturer for the individual who might have been shut out in other areas. And I understand that while it's not widely approached that way, it is an option that's available to individuals in the context of equipment.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, I will say in the instance of Mr. Sharp, his outcome was exceedingly rare. And even the attorneys were surprised that they were able to bring that action. It is not a course of action that anyone would recommend, and that your success level is likely very small.
We have some questions over here. We also have another of the key stakeholders is back in the room now, Mr. Gardner, and we didn't want to be giving just one perspective here. I wanted to
I sent the brainwaves, and he knew you were called.
Mr. Chair, maybe especially with our time limited, maybe we could take a little bit more time for the parties to try and work something out here.
Yeah, I'm obviously we're back into a set of very complicated issues, and it's I think it's been a useful discussion. And my understanding is that our committee, the substantial portion of our committee is committed elsewhere at 10:15.
One question.
Yeah, let's do. I mean, I think we were prepared to roll some things over, and actually we've covered a lot of ground today, so we can roll over the rest of the agenda and use this remaining time to make sure we have all the input and make sure we're making well-considered decisions. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Of the 40 states you mentioned, and that can be for any one of them if you know, that they have a statute of repose, how many of them have a cap that gives a different type of protection?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Krieger, sitting here before you right now, I don't have the answer to that question. I could get it very quickly. My colleague, Mr. Gardner, may be finding it at his fingertips, but I can get that information to you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the number of Jim Gardner, sorry. representing pharma. The number of states that have caps on non-economic damages is not a number I have at my fingertips either, but I did provide earlier to the committee a ranking of Oregon's tort climate in terms of its business friendliness, which I think you all will recall.
And what that takes into account is not only the existence of caps on non-economic damages, but such things as level of exposure to punitive damages, length of statutes of limitation, lengths of statutes of repose, and the like. And it essentially was a study done by the U.S. Chamber, and it amalgamates all of those into an overall tort score, if you will, which we feel is a much more realistic way of evaluating the overall tort exposure, the tort climate that a manufacturer might face in a particular state. And as you will recall, according to that list prepared by the U.S. Chamber, Oregon is in the bottom half of the class in terms of business friendliness. The components of that, of course, will vary depending on, for instance, Oregon has a very robust punitive damages regime in a recent case providing 100 times actual damages. Washington has none, Washington being the model for the, essentially for the fives and the sevens.
And Mr. Chair, if I could please, Jim Markey on behalf of Pharma, I think this points out that you simply can't take one element of a tort system in any given state and compare it to another state without looking at the entire tort system in both states. It just doesn't work.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm not sure Mr. Gardner was in the room when I asked Mr. Trester, but I'd love to hear your comments on the Dash 7 approach.
Yes, I did have actually detailed comments, which if I could just pass those out. The Dash 7s, we believe, have many of the same problems as the Dash 5 amendments in that they do not provide definitive repose until after the expiration of 20 years from the purchase of the product. And we feel that time period is excessive, far longer than the current repose period of 10 years, which is the 8 plus 2 if the injury is discovered on the last day of the 8th year. In addition, and this may be an artifact of LC drafting decisions, but in addition, the Dash 7 amendments have some serious unintended consequences. Line 9 on page 2, for instance, states, quote, all products have a useful, safe life of at least 10 years, unquote. All products. And this is simply not a true statement. All products do not have a useful safe life of at least 10 years. A prescription drug, for instance, has a useful safe life of perhaps a year or less. It's simply an untrue statement. And by making that as a legislative fact, I really don't know what the consequences of that might be for escalating or changing product liability beyond the statute of repose context in terms of the substantive exposure. And as a public policy matter, we think it's simply poor public policy to recite a legislative determination that's demonstrably false.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Flores.
Mr. Tressiter, then back to my question about the safe life of a prescription drug that clearly has an expiration date. This would, Dash 7 language would seem to override that. And as you indicated, we get into court and say you don't have a case because the drug clearly said.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Flores, there may in fact be a drafting issue involved here. I believe what the amendments mean to say is that inside of 10 years it's presumed to be a useful life, safe life. It is not a statement of fact. It's presumed to have a useful life.
Mr. Chair.
May I respond just to that quick question, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Gardner.
Yeah. If it's a presumption, it's what's known in the law as a conclusive presumption when it is written in this fashion, and that means it is a fact. It is a conclusively presumed fact.
Let's hear from counsel on what the instruction was given to the legislative council.
The intent of the Dash 7s was to not shorten the existing statute of repose. And so this is the way they did it, by going to a useful safe life standard and saying, okay, the useful safe life is 10 years. So you would automatically have what you have now. The difference would be the extension from 10 to 20 years, during which there would be this rebuttal presumption that it's beyond the useful safe life. So that was the intent in the drafting of the Dash 7. So there wouldn't be any circumstances where there would be a useful safe life under 10 years.
Great. Just like there isn't one of under 8 years now.
Which is the current law.
Representative Bonamici.
I just want to point out that the last sentence in that paragraph, Mr. Gardner read the first sentence, but the last sentence says the presumption established by this subsection may be rebutted by a preponderance of the evidence, right, which is what Mr. Tresor was talking about. If your prescription says it expires at a certain date, you're going to have a really hard time getting that case past a summary judgment motion. But the question I wanted to ask about the, you used a punitive damage example that was, what, 100 times or 1,000 times. Is that the one that was just overturned by the Supreme Court?
Madam, Mr. Chair, Representative Bonamici, yes. And it's back, I think it's on its third trip back to the Oregon Supreme Court in that particular case.
Right. So I think it's important, if you're going to use an example, that it was 100 or 1,000 times, that to say that it was reversed by the Supreme Court is sort of an important fact in that.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, I use that to illustrate the not the constitutional constraints imposed by the U.S. Supreme Court, but rather the proclivity of Oregon Supreme Court, the Oregon Supreme Court, to robustly impose punitive damages.
Follow up?
Go ahead.
Were the punitive damages were probably imposed by the jury, not by the Supreme Court?
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that is correct. It was, I think the determination was an improper jury instruction.
Okay. I just got concerned. I didn't think the Supreme Court could impose punitive damages.
Chair McPherson, Representative Bonamici, that's correct.
So, committee, we have come to the end of the time available to us because I think nearly half the committee has another commitment here at 10:15. I'm going to, I guess it's close or recess. We're going to go out of the work session on House Bill 2909, and we're going to roll over the continuation of that work session on House Bill 2909. The work sessions on House Bills 3407, 2847, and 3241. And on 3420 to next day's agenda, and the public hearings on House Bills 2331 and 2327. Committee, you may have noticed that we posted the rollover items for 7 a.m. tomorrow morning. But do check in before at the end of the day, and we'll see how much is going to be done in that hour from 7 to 8, because it may be we could gavel in at 7:30 or something a little later and give people a little bit more time to get here. But
I won't be here.
And I understand that Representative Barker will not be here.
Around for an hour waiting for you.
Very good. Well, I will then close the meeting of the House Judiciary Committee or adjourn here for Thursday, April 26th.